Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. So excited for you guys to join us again. So thankful for all the listeners. Bumped us up over 10,000. We just got invited to the Coast Guard Festival in Grand Haven. Big things are happening to this show. So, we couldn't do that without you guys and without our guests. So huge thank you to everyone.
Yeah, thank you everybody out there for listening and sticking with us. We appreciate it. If it's your first time listening, thanks for finding us. We hope you like what you hear. Please go give us a review when you do like what you hear, because we know you will.
Yeah, and do it on iTunes. 5 stars would be preferred. You know, anything less than 3, you don't have to give us a review. You can just keep moving.
Save your thumb energy at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, and as a payback for our listeners, we're going to get into the mind of someone that does a job that a lot of people have a lot of questions about.
Right.
Or that people try to avoid like the plague. I don't know, both. But very excited to have him on. And on the line today, we've got Mr. Chris Huntington. Born and raised in North Dakota. Joined the Coast Guard back in December 99 with Company Sierra 156. Came in just before me. Went from there to FTA school. FT. Tell me what FT is, Chris. I missed it.
Fire control technician.
Yep, don't have them anymore.
Right. Which and, we'll find out in a minute in his bio.
Right. Yeah, incredibly long C school. I remember. I mean, like years. But first operational unit once he graduated in 2001 was the Coast Guard Cutter Dallas, home ported out of Charleston, South Carolina. Stayed on there till 2004, where he made and transitioned to electronics technician second class. The FT rating was absorbed by the ETs. Went from there where I was able to meet him at Maritime Safety and Security Team 9/11/14 down in Miami, Florida. Did a 4-year tour with me there when he was, while at the MIST, deployed down to Gitmo, made first class, and got picked up for the Coast Guard Investigative Service, or CGIS. Once selected for a position with them, went to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center out in Glencoe. Completed criminal investigator training and NCIS's agents course. First CGIS assignment was at the Washington field office in Arlington. While he was there, he made chief warrant officer. It's a CWO investigator. And went from there to the office in Bahrain, resident agent office Bahrain, or RAO Bahrain. In 2013, then went to the Miami field office up until 2017 and saw some greener grass and was able to transition to another federal agency. Now works for the Environmental Protection Agency with their OIG Office of Investigations. And with that, I will let Bill get this thing kicked off.
All right, Chris. So we're hoping for, we know we're going to get a good one based on the Seagis background we're hoping for. What's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
I would say that I have the two different sides of the daring and epic. I had the side while I was wearing the uniform, and then obviously transitioning to Seagis. Once you go to civilian clothes and you're still working for the Coast Guard, it's a whole different world of stories that come open. You leave the boat riding behind or the flying in the helicopters, and it goes to, you know, like going out and into the public and chasing down different things. So my first story that I really, really enjoy was actually when I was wearing the uniform and I was stationed with Phil in at the MSST. I was a boarding officer, and they needed people to fly in the back of helicopters for the NCR ADF, the National Capital Region Air Defense Force. And I don't know, do they still send?
I don't know.
The MSST guys up there?
I do remember when you got orders to that, and everybody was, one, we didn't know what it was, and then when we figured out what it was, everybody was crazy envious that that you were the one that got selected for that. So yeah, crazy mission.
It was a lot of fun, especially for someone that spent his entire, like, I spent my entire time on the water, and I love the water, but to be sent up to fly in the back of helicopters, and like your only responsibility is to sit back there with the gun and the, you know, the law enforcement authority to help them out. It was pretty awesome. And then you get a little jealous of the Airedale life, and I didn't realize how many lazy boys could fit in an office.
We didn't say it. That wasn't us. That was Chris.
Totally not. We love the Airedales. Please come on, tell us stories.
One big office, lots of lazy boys, and several Xboxes. But I loved it. They took care of us.
The masseuse table and the pool and yeah.
They need to be physically fit.
I know, yeah. We were told the other day that they had a beach by Air Station Borniquin so that they could work out.
I don't know if you were on that trip with us, but we did get deployed down to Puerto Rico, and they had us staying in the bungalows that are there on the beach for them.
The bungalows.
The bungalows.
Yeah, they don't have that hard of a life. But anyways, so getting sent up there, the whole mission was for then to send the LEOs from the MSSTs to find the back of the helicopters. And the whole point was to look for low-slow flyers that were violating airspace over D.C. Really great mission. I'm glad the Coast Guard has it because you got this bright, visible orange helicopter flying around showing the flag. Our job was, like, if we did interact and the pilots were able to communicate with the other pilot and have them land, we would go out and interact with the person that was forced to land. It's a job that you think is never, ever going to happen, but you make a little nest in the back of the helo with a bunch of pillows, and you just kind of, like, cuddle up back there, and you spend all day flying around. It's good and it's bad.
Airedale life.
There's no lazy boy in the back of the helo?
No, so okay. The flight mech, he gets his nice cush seat. The two pilots get their cush seats, and then the LEO is like, yeah, you get the swimmer seat, and it's just, like, the hard metal deck back there. And they would give us hard times, or at least me hard. I'd bring like three or four pillows and just, like, stuff them back there and try and make like a little. Because while they're flying one sortie a day, as the LEO, you have to fly two to three sorties a day. So you're always in the back of the helicopter, and they get just, you know, their one little trip, and then they get to go back to their lazy boys. So we try to make it a little comfortable. But flying around, you never think it's going to happen, but you're always amped and hoping that it will. And we're in the middle of a patrol, and then we get the call. And I remember the OS on the radio was like pretty frantic, and we had a target. And so the pilots, they're amped and they're chatting away, and I'm like scrambling to look out a window, just like I'm like a little rabid dog in the back, like, oh my god, we get to go play. And it's a weird feeling to sit in the back and you have no control over anything, like you're just sitting there hoping that they let you go out and play, and you're bouncing off the walls back there. It's exciting, your heart's thumping, and we're flying hard, and we look down and we find our target. The flight mech had found him. He's like, hey, there he is. I'm looking at him. It's just a little I don't know, it's not a Cessna, it's a little bit bigger than that, but it's a prop plane, and it's below us. And so the pilots say, okay, cool, we'll interdict. And we go down. And I think they were a little too excited at the time because we blew right past that dude. So we dive down and, like, you kind of hear a couple expletives, and we pull back up, and they're pulling hard and then coming. I forget which way we had to turn, left or right. And we're banking. They're saying, where is he? We're all looking out the windows. Then all of a sudden, in the front of the helicopter is this plane with this propellers coming directly towards us. And you can see the prop of the plane. And all I remember, I don't remember any other words, is the pilot screaming an expletive and then dump collective. I had no idea what that meant because, again, I'm in the back. I have no control over anything. All I heard was dump collective. It's the one thing that sticks in my mind. And then all of a sudden, the helicopter goes nose down and just shoots straight down towards Earth. So it was either smash into the plane or now there's giant trees that are in the front of the helicopter.
How high are you guys? Like, are you – I mean, you probably weren't monitoring altitude, but, like, you know, are you like
– I have no idea. I if I was to guess, like – it's only a couple hundred feet up.
Yeah.
So I see the
at the end, you were like 5 feet off the ground, right? Like, yeah, let's tell the story, right?
You could read license plates and see squirrels and stuff, right?
I think I could see individual trees, and like I'm kind of floating in the back, and I'm grabbing onto stuff to keep my butt on the ground, and I'm giggling because it's about the only thing I can do at the time because. Like, you can't get mad, because what's that going to get you? Yeah, if you get scared, then you lose, like, any situation. So I'm actually laughing back there, which I don't think the pilots enjoyed. And then they pull up out of the dive. We come back around. We've lost the plane. We've slowed down. We've kind of, like, I think they took a minute to, like, okay, we need to reassess. We kind of messed that one up. And we see the plane. He's off in the distance. We kind of trail him. And they got him on the radio, and they were able to talk him down to the airport. We follow him in, and now it's my turn. I'm like, oh my god, this is my chance. I get to go out. So I'm like at the door, I'm at the ready, and the pilots are yelling at me, go sit back down. I'm like, no, we're gonna go get this guy, let's jump out, let's go get him. I'm like, no, go sit back down, we're returning the base. And I'm like, what? Oh man, this sucks. So Secret Service was contacted to go back. The ride back was probably the quietest flight I've ever had with a bunch of pilots.
Oh, I can't imagine. Yeah, they know they just let you down. They almost slammed the plane into the
basically, helo. What you're telling me is a Coast Guard helo lost a dogfight with a Cessna that wasn't even in the dogfight.
yeah. So ahead of time, it turns out that the guy just didn't have his radio on and he wasn't listening, but then he saw a big orange helicopter go shoot past him, and then he turned on his radio or something along those lines.
And you guys had a sign, right? Wasn't that the deal? There's a sign.
Yeah.
What's the sign say? I remember the sign.
The sign could say, like, you know, turn left now, turn right. You could, like, it had, like, these pre-programmed things that you could do. The flight mechs, they'd never let us LEOs touch it because, like, we'd just be messing, pressing buttons nonstop.
Right.
So, like, no, like, slap you on the hand. Like, no, don't touch that. Like, sorry, my bad. So it would, like, I think flash red and blue to kind of give, like, the police, like, hey, we're pulling you over.
That is funny, man. Like, it was on the door, too, right? Like, around the door. Yeah, so.
No, it's not on the door. It's actually above the window where you sit as the swimmer or the LEO. So, like, you're kind of, like, hanging over the sign just to try and get, like, this little sliver of a window to see what's going on. So you're
looking out, like, flashing the action a little bit, just, like, showing them that it's coming, right? Like, that's pretty good, yeah.
It's pretty much just to get their attention. Right. And so normally I'm guessing you guys have flown in helicopters before, like with the Coast Guard, right?
Yes. Yeah, it wasn't quite as brutal as your Red Bull stunt helicopter experience. Yeah,
mine was much less eventful.
But when you fly, like, there is no stopping those pilots from chatting away. Like, it's just nonstop chatter. To me, it seemed like they were constantly chatting.
Whether they're filling out a checklist or just... Right. Yeah,
they were like tour guides for me the one time I flew, because I was somewhere I'd never been. Yeah. It was like my tour.
And then they'll just, like... It's like being on the boat. Like, you'll just start going off on a random conversation. It was just nonstop with those guys. But that was the quietest ride. The flight mech was quiet. The pilot was quiet. The co-pilot was quiet. I'm in the back going, dude, we had them. Why didn't we land? Come on, guys. Let's go back. Let's get them. And they're just like, hush.
Hush.
We land, so we fly back to Reagan National, and we land, and I get out, like, I'm like holding up my hand, like high five, like, yeah, we got in their face, oh, we got them, yeah, we did what we need to do, because I'm thinking of it from, like, the boat side. So, like, if you do a security patrol with the MSST, you know, like, you'd set up the perimeter, like, a boat comes in, you go, you challenge. If they want to get, like, a little squirrely, maybe you splash a little water up on them, maybe a little bump, like, you get in their face. And so that's where my mindset was. I'm like, yes, this is awesome. And apparently the Aerials don't like that. For them, like, that's a bad thing. And this is the first time I was ever called a boatie. So I didn't know that that was like a thing.
That's a thing? That's really a thing?
That's what I learned today. I didn't know that was a thing either.
So like I kept getting called, "You boaties don't understand."
And did you have a comeback? Tell me you had a comeback.
It was just more of a smile and just like.
Yeah, like did really? That just come really? Out of your mouth? Like, did you really just call me that?
I mean, if that's the worst you got, if that's the worst you're gonna call me, I'm good.
Go sit in your lazy boy. Sure. Go sit in your lazy boy. And come up with something better.
But I had no idea like how bad of a deal this was, and again, like I was congratulating the pilots, like I wanted to like just slap them on the back, like, "Yo guys, you did the mission, good job, get some, you know, like it's okay." Like, yes, it was a little scary, but dude, it was an awesome trip.
Yeah, like, we protected the capital region, right? Like we cleared out an air contact, I would think.
Exactly. Like, so in my mind, I'm like, "Yo, we did the job," and then. Like, I'm being asked for statements for the FAA, and there's an investigation going on, and I'm filling out every form with a giant smile going, "Dude, we almost died, that was awesome. Dude, we almost died, that was awesome." And again, you stupid boaties don't understand. I'm like, "All right, cool, well, I had a good time. Thanks, guys, for the ride."
Right, sitting in front of the NTSB hearing, and there's you like, "Man, we did awesome," and people were just
Did soft. You get, like, a reputation around the air station then? Everybody was like, "Well, you don't want to fly with him, he's crazy." Like,
no, I don't. Maybe I don't think so. I don't think you know though. I think if you would have put any other guy from our team in the back of the helicopter, they would have come back with the biggest smile on their face, going, "Dude, you are not going to believe what just happened."
Oh yeah, for sure.
Oh yeah.
So I had a blast with that. I remember there were some PowerPoints that were flying around showing like our flight path, and I was like, "Oh wow, that's where we were," and it was like, "Okay, that's kind of cool." And like it kind of hit like when I got home and like. I had to talk to the command, and, like, they had to get an understanding. But it was like, I was never in trouble, because, again, it's cool. Like, it's like you're in the back.
Yeah, they were telling me to just sit down on my pillows.
Yep, they were giving me crap for my pillows. But, yeah, it was fun.
Dude, and I would say more power to you, Chris, because, like, I've logged a lot of hours, too, with auxiliary pilots, like on area fams and just patrols and stuff. And the one time, man, the dude moves the stick to the right, and I don't know what happened, but we, like, gained altitude, and we turned really hard. I've never been more sick in my life, man. I think I lost, like 40 pounds of water just sweating in that guy's chair, and he's looking over like, "Are you going to be okay?" So, yeah, that you made it through that and still had a smile on your face, it's pretty impressive.
Again, it comes back to, like, I have no control over this, so which path am I going to choose? Am I going to be sitting in the back scared, like, crying? Am I going to get, like, mad at the guys for, like, what they're doing? Or am I just going to sit back, enjoy this, and just, like, let's see where this goes?
Right? Yeah.
So.
Yeah, the worst that happens is we give you a crazy good funeral in Arlington.
Right.
Really, I mean, at that point, right? Yeah.
So that was my fun, like, one of my fun trips, I think, with the uniform. I mean, I did have a blast. We did a lot of things when I was on the Cutter Dallas. We got involved in a lot of stuff, deployed for the war at the very beginning, sitting off the coast of Syria. Doing escort ops through the Straits of Gibraltar, was down in Haiti for the removal of Aristide.
Let's talk about that. Just since you mentioned it, that deployment for the war, because we've had one wartime guest so far.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't know that the Coast Guard deploys in support of wartime efforts and DOD efforts. Can you talk about that deployment a little bit? Especially, I mean, you were probably pretty much brand new to the Cutter, right? Hadn't been there too long.
I'd been there for maybe a year before we deployed, because we actually started, ramping up wartime operations, like, 2002, right?
Yeah, and you're the weapons guy. You were the weapons guy.
Yeah.
Oh, no, so I remember 9/11, when it happened, as a weapons guy, like, when the plane hit the second tower, like, us FTs, we'd already unlocked our ammo lockers, and we were sitting outside the CWIS, like, ready to load up, like, just sitting on our ammo cans, like, waiting for the captain to say, "Do it." So, I mean, yeah, weapons were huge for us. Going over for the war operations, CWIS was huge. Granted, CWIS hasn't been used in combat situations for maritime. I love what they're using it for on Army bases. It's absolutely awesome what they do, shooting down mortars. But for maritime operations, it really hasn't been used, but you want it ready. You want it to be able to shoot down that incoming threat. So,
will you describe that gun for any? I mean, I know that's things near and dear to your heart, Chris. Like, for everybody that doesn't know what CWIS is, you know, what's the capability?
CWIS looks like a giant R2D2 with a bunch of with six barrels sticking out of it. I guess that's a clean version of it. And It's a giant Gatling gun that shoots 20-millimeter bullets. The Coast Guard uses tungsten. The Navy uses depleted uranium and tungsten. But these bullets, pretty much the concept is to identify incoming air threats and to eliminate it, and it's all autonomous. So you can turn SeaWiz on. It has the radar system. It has the capability. And if it senses a missile coming in towards the ship, it will look for it. It'll find it. It'll lock in on it. It'll destroy the target, and then it'll go right to the next target. So, like, you can keep track of multiple things going on. And the concept is to put up a wall of lead to stop whatever's coming at you. And it's about 100 rounds a second.
That's badass. That's awesome. Yeah, that really is.
And the Coast Guard has evolved with the technology of it right now. I'm just going to throw a little plug out there for this. I love what they're doing with it. They've got the Block 1 Bravo, which is a version that can shoot surface targets. So you guys should find someone that can give you a little bit more knowledge on that about, you know, turning a boat to Swiss cheese with that gun.
What was it called again?
It's called the SeaWiz Block 1 Bravo. It's on the new National Security Cutters.
You're a good salesman for it, Chris. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was sold, you know, like wall of lead. I like right. it. Yeah, I want one.
So, yeah, for the beginning of the war, we actually got underway and sat in Bermuda for quite a while, knowing that orders were to come, but we didn't even have orders to deploy. So... We
you got to sit somewhere. Bermuda's not a bad spot.
You're right.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
get to pull in.
Oh, yeah. We stayed in Bermuda for like, five days,
yeah.
like chilling, waiting out. My buddy, who's out of the Coast Guard now, Casey Campbell, he made it on the front page of their newspaper because it freaked them out because he was standing in security watch and he had the shotgun. And Bermuda being a territory or an ex-British territory, no guns. Like, that's like a big no-no. And here's this dude standing with, like, a big gun. And it really, really freaked out the locals. So, like, they had to change the whole security posture of, like, you know, what was visible and what was not. But he was front page news out there.
Well, that's funny.
And then from there, we crossed the Atlantic.
If they only knew what the SeaWiz did.
Right.
Yeah, just a big dome on the back of the boat. We crossed the Atlantic, hit some bad seas, like 45-foot seas, which was a lot of fun.
Did you guys go solo, or were you part of, like, a group?
Oh, no, it was just by us. It was just by ourselves. And then we got over to we got to Rota, Spain, and we docked there for a while. And we waited for some freighters that were coming across with the 110s that were mounted on them. And we escorted them through the Straits of Gibraltar so then they could start operations in the Med. I don't know they really did much out there, but I know that the intention was for them to start doing boardings looking for fleeing Iraqi leadership at the beginning of the war. Mm. I got to go up in the Hilo to take some pictures of like the Dallas and them together. So like I was also the ship's photographer. Well, I was a jack of all trades on that, but I loved it. But we did escort operations with the Navy running through Straits of Gibraltar, and then eventually they moved all surface assets through to the other side, down around into the Persian Gulf. So we were the only surface combatant, which is kind of funny to say if you know Coast Guard cutters. And we were sailing with one of the carriers. So we were their surface combatant. And sailing with a carrier is fun until you have to be their safety behind the ship to help planes land where they dump all their fuel all over you.
Oh, man, I never thought about that. Wow. That happens, so, like, huh?
Yeah, they extinguish the smoke and lamp, and no one's allowed outside because you're just getting dumped with JP-5 and JP-8 as they're coming in to land on the back of the carrier.
Wow, man, and, like, red-hot decks anyway, right? Like, I'm assuming over there with the heat. That's crazy.
Actually, it was chilly while we were there. I remember that. It was actually pretty cold, sitting off the coast of Syria. Syria at the time, and I think at all times, has not been very friendly to us. We would, with direction of the Navy, we would sit like 12 miles off of Syria. And this is while they still had like full control of their country. And every night, 8 a.m. or 8 p.m., some dude from Syria would get on the radio on Channel 16 and just sing out to us, "F you, America."
So did anybody reply?
Nah, you just leave it alone.
Yeah, you never know.
But, somebody that bored on watch just gets on the radio.
Right. Who knows what happened to in the morning.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we got to do that, and then we started doing some boarding operations. We were looking for the fleeing Iraqi leadership that was supposed to come through Syria, hit the Med, and then go, like, hide up in Europe. We did some boardings with that. It was kind of funny because the Navy required us to prove to them that we knew how to do boardings. So they came over and observed us doing boardings. And we sent like the C team to go do the boardings, and that impressed them enough.
Probably taught them a few things.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, they're over there taking notes.
Yeah, yeah. So overall, it was a good deployment. We didn't get to do like there wasn't a whole lot of combat operations, but it was cool to see the jets leave fully loaded and then return empty.
Right.
Like they were dispensing some justice over there. We got to pull into Split Croatia, into Italy, and then Spain, and then head back over Madeira. Some really, really fun ports once we finally hit them.
Yeah, and how long were you guys over there, Chris?
We were there for, man, I want to say it was like 3 months, yeah. A 3 month deployment, something like that. Yeah, it was about 3 or 4 months. And then we had about 50 something days straight underway, which was pretty rough.
Like, yeah, that's rough. That's really rough.
That's a long time.
And the Navy guys, they sit there and go, oh, that's nothing. I'm like, dude, I was on a cutter, which is smaller than your like frigate. Like, it's. Right. We were drinking powdered milk, yeah, and eating brown lettuce.
I was gonna say we're down to peanut butter and jelly sandwiches at that point.
Yeah,
we don't have Subways on, you know, our ships like your carriers do.
Right. I just said wow, and people were like, "God, what a win!" You know, I'm sure that's what.
I mean,
you guys try it, right?
Coming from my background, more than about 17 days on the 210 was too much.
Yeah, you like, guys start like thinking about eating each other.
You're out of lettuce. You're out of You're.
Yeah, it becomes like Groundhog's Day, right. And, but, you know, you make the most of it. I think at that time, one of the Star Wars movies had just been released, so we got, like, some bootleg copy, and we did, like, a flight deck movie, so that kind of, like, kept up morale, and you got to do a couple little things like that.
Very cool. Yeah, I was just curious about, it's probably the first time that I've heard, at least, that initial deployment to following the war outbreak, so pretty cool.
Yeah, one of the impressive things, like not even during that deployment, was being in Charleston. That's where a lot of the transport jets are kept for the Air Force, the big C-5s or whatever they are. And right before we left, it was like ominous because like their entire squadron flew out over us. And to see a squadron of those things fly out to go to war, and you know they're fully loaded, like it's, oh my God, this is real.
Right.
And then Charleston's also a main port for the Military Sealift Command. And to see them loaded up with tanks and all the goodies that go along with like making things go boom overseas, to see them leave the port, because they don't ever leave like all together. Like to see every single one of them leave the port, you're just like, oh, dude, we're next. And shortly after, we went right out and followed them.
And Chris, like just out of curiosity, what's the wartime brief versus the more peacetime brief, like to the cutter crew? Are you operating any differently? Is it, you know, is it the same? I'm just curious how that goes down.
It's ROE. I mean, you're basically detailed to the Navy at that point. Like, it's like, okay, you're going to the 7th Fleet. So, like, whatever tasking they have, go do.
Right.
Like, go forth and conquer.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things, like, I remember us doing escort ops. Through the Straits of Gibraltar, it's awesome. Like, you look to the right, there's Africa. Look to the left, there's Europe. And it's just filled with small boat contacts. And they don't care who you are, because that's their water. Like, that's how they, you know, you see the smugglers come, and they see you, and they think, like, you're Italian Coast Guard, so they start dumping all their cigarettes and stuff overboard. And they're gonna run for you, like, what? All right, cool. But, like, you don't know, like, it's such a tight zone, and what they do is that, you know, you pack all your ships together, and then you make, like, a high-speed run through the straits, and you got destroyers, you got frigates, you got us, you got, like, all the these contracted ships, and you make a run for it. And the rule was, like,
BM3 plotting 3-minute fixes.
I mean, at that point, you have the Mark 92, which is the weapons control radar for the larger cannon up front. And you have SeaWiz on, you have all the other raiders, like, everybody's, like, you're at battle stations, like, you're going through, and, like, you go, and if the rule was, like, if there's a ship that falls out, or, like, its engines fail, it's on its own, we'll come back for it, we gotta get the fleet through first, and then you go back for it. So it's just, like, this rule, it's this weird feeling of, like, oh, we leave people behind, like, if we have to, like, that seems kind of weird, like, shouldn't we, like, protect them? And it's, like, it's, no, it's for the greater good, you just push.
So you guys were at GQ the whole time through there?
There were times where we'd go through, it was like a modified GQ, like, it was like, be at the ready, be at your stations. Like, you'd have people on the 50 cals, you'd have people on the 25s, And yeah, I don't want to say it was like everything was locked down, but
right, like almost like a structural zebra, but you weren't like shutting off ventilation and all that stuff the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sounds like a World War II convoy.
That would be fun.
Really,
yeah,
what it is?
Yeah, it sounds like fun. We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT. All right, Chris, let's get into it. Plain clothes. Actually, before we kick it off, I'm having worked with many three-letter. Yeah, you still got us?
Oh.
Hey, we lost you. Bill put you on mute.
So, the phone has a mind of its own. Sorry about that, Chris.
That's awesome. That
hey,
quiet.
Before we get into the plainclothes thing, working with a lot of three-letter agencies, right? Each one has like its own informal dress code, I think. Like the FBI, it's either when they're in the field, they're like Boy Scouts, right? Like they're wearing the vests and the North Face. When they're in, in a more business setting, they're always wearing the black suits, black tie, white shirt. ICE, it always seems like they're going to the club. Like, the shirt's unbuttoned to their navel. And then I would say the Secret Service, kind of like the FBI, but instead of the Boy Scout look, and outside of the business setting, it's like FUBU wear. What's the informal dress code for CGIS?
So officially, when I was in, it's suit and tie. Like, that's what the old headquarters and the old manual says. Like, you will wear a suit and tie for everything. And that's just impractical. Like, when I was in D.C., yes, it was suit and tie, like, for a good majority of the stuff I was doing.
REO Bahrain, probably not so much.
Yeah, there's no such thing. Like, even when we were running protection detail and they wanted you in suit, there's still no tie. Right. So it's a little different. But like, you could go down, it all depends on what the guys are doing. Like, the further away from the flagpole you get, a little bit more like less strict it gets with like what they want you dressed as, but like, be professional. Like, that's basically the go-to rule. And it is with like any agency really that you start working for. It's like, just be professional. Now, you don't see that all the time. But like, you could imagine, like, if you're in Key West and you're sitting there, watching some smugglers, you're not going to be dressed in, like, 5'11s, or you're not going to be dressed in a suit and tie. You're wearing flip-flops and shorts and, like, a tank top. And, like, that's just what you got to do.
That's what the good ones are wearing. The other ones are wearing
5'11".
Right. The ones that think they're good are wearing 5'11". Yeah, the good ones
are
the dead giveaway.
Yeah.
Yeah, the 5'11s, that's for range and for, like, if you don't care that you're going to be outed as an LEO.
Right.
But for where I was in D.C., a lot of times it was suit and tie. But that is, like, that's the camouflage. Like, if you're walking around, like, the mall area of D.C. and you're wearing a suit and tie, nobody cares. Like, you fit in.
That's true. Right. It's a good way to put that.
And it's fine. It's professional, too. Like, you go to a meeting and you're not wearing a suit and tie, they're not going to take you as seriously sometimes, depending on the meeting. Now, sometimes you show up to a suit and tie, like, in a suit and tie to certain meetings. Like, with one of the stories I'll tell you, like a certain task force or like a working group that does nothing but like, auto crime and thefts. Like, you see them in a suit and tie, they're like, dude, what are you doing? Like,
yeah.
What are you someone important? Like, is that what this is? Or like, they'll give you a hard time.
So I'm thinking like Marshall's fugitive task force. Like, you walked in here in a suit and tie and not in your ballistic vest. You can just leave. Yeah. I got you.
Yeah. So it comes down to like, Wear your big boy, big girl pants and do what's right, do what's responsible. I mean, there are some people that, start straying away from it and just zero care given, and then they'll just do whatever they want. But for the most part, you got to keep it professional.
You guys are all an enigma to us anyway.
Yeah. It's another unicorn.
Yeah.
Like, we know you're real, but
right,
you kind of want to know, but you kind of hope to never really see them during your whole career.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
So during my time with CGIS, I really, like, I understand what you're saying right there, but I also thought that if CGIS had a good positive influence on the command, like, and was present, especially with, like, the local stations, then there's a good influence over those people there, and you might even have less incidents that occur because CGIS is known to be around. I would go to the local stations that I dealt with, especially in South Florida, and I would go talk to all the BOs, like, always shaking their hand, coming up, like, seeing how things are going, because if you look at it this way, like, yes, CGIS does internal investigations. They do. That's part of the business. We would rather do external investigations. And with that being said, like, the BOs and the coxswains, you guys are the patrol division. You're the police officers that are out there finding the bad guys. CGIS is the one that comes in off of the tips that you give them to do investigations.
Right. I always think the FIST team, the guys that were assigned to FIST teams, were very approachable, right? The ones that were still assigned to internal is a different story.
Right. I mean, all great points. I think that's an important thing to highlight because most people don't think of that. They think of the internal investigation, mm-hmm. for sure.
And, you know, if you have some really good proactive boarding officers, like, they can reach out to the CGIS office, and they should, pull them in. Like, I had one guy, he's actually now a special agent with HSI, Lafferty. This guy was amazing down in Miami. He would call me up all the time. Like, one time he just showed up in my office. I'm like, who are you? He's like, all right, dude, here's this guy. He's dirty. This guy. Like boaters that are out there that, like, he kept coming across, and, like, he knew stuff was going on. I'm like, dude, this is awesome. Thank you. And, like, we'd open up cases and go after, you know, people doing illegal stuff. Not coasties, but people out in town.
Right. Yeah, very good point on the external mission plus the internal.
Yeah.
Where were you at when the story happened?
Well, let's see. I'll tell you the Bahrain story. I'll go back. I'll tell you the D.C. story. So when I was in the Washington field office, I was a rookie agent, and I had just wrapped up an investigation. Bossed up a bad organization, a bad group of people. The rumor persists that, oh my God, CGIS is still looking at us, and then, like, new people will start filtering in, and that fear disappears, and then it all starts over again. But unfortunately, during that time, we had taken down, I want to say, about 14 people. Drug use, mass larceny. There was even, like, reports of assaults and some other stuff going on. It was really bad. We ended up arresting two of them for purchasing stolen automatic rifles, but I didn't want cash, so I got them to give us cocaine.
Good. Well,
we offered the one guy a grenade. He kind of laughed, and he turned that one down, so we were cool with that. So one of the subjects in that case, he owned a motorcycle, and he kept it on base, and that motorcycle was at one point stolen. So some people had come to the TISCOM base and had cut the fence line, laid it down, snuck on, grabbed his motorcycle, rolled it off, and then took off on his bike, which is pretty ballsy to break into a military installation like that. But what most people don't know is, like, or I'll ask you guys, what do you think the crime is for? Like, what level of crime is breaking onto a military installation?
Felony.
No, it's a misdemeanor.
I was going to say, I would have guessed felony, but I could kind of tell by the way you were leading there.
Yeah. So it's a misdemeanor.
I thought there was going to be another step.
Like death sentence.
What did I miss? Like
treason.
Straight to Gibbo.
It's a misdemeanor, and you have to have signs. It's all this other crazy stuff, but it's a misdemeanor. So, like, all they did was they committed a misdemeanor against the government, and then they committed a felony against the Coast Guard member. But they took his bike, and then they ran it from Virginia to Maryland. So guess what? That's a felony, and that's a federal crime.
Right. Cross state lines.
And that's in connection to breaking onto the military base. So I had jurisdiction. Now, my bosses at CGIS, they weren't the most thrilled with opening up a motorcycle theft ring investigation. But we did it. And I worked with some amazing officers with Fairfax County Police Department, Prince George's County, and Metro PD. Like, we all banded together, and Arlington PD. We all banded together, kind of created this ad hoc task force, and we started tracking these guys that were stealing motorcycles. And it was all over. They would come over to Virginia, where people would leave their motorcycles out, and they think they'd be safe with the lock. But watching these guys, they could pop the lock and rewire your motorcycle and be gone in about 20 seconds.
comforting.
Yeah.
Right.
So if you own a motorcycle in Northern Virginia area, do some precautionary measures to lock up your bike, because from what I hear, a lot of them are back at it again. So we track these guys. We do the investigation. It's about 6 months of chasing these dudes. We had done a search warrant on the main character's house, and it's actually his mom's house, and we smashed.
Of course, it was his mom's house.
Right. Yeah. And there's a rule in Prince George's County, like a lot of areas, that if you're going to do a felony warrant, you need to have SWAT do it. Now, it was our warrant. It was CGIS. We could have just done the warrant, the warrant execution ourselves, but why not have SWAT do it? Like, that's what they're there for. They enjoy it. As much fun as it is, it's a lot of fun to see these guys smash a door off its hinges and take down the house. So they got to do that. We found a gun in the house, so he was trading motorcycles for guns. And he wasn't there. He took off. He was in the wind. He was running. So we're chasing this guy, and kind of identify that he's over in the East Cap Street area in this little neighborhood. And so I start setting up surveillance with the PD guys. So I'm sitting out there, and there were times where I would have my Mark 18 with me, which is the smaller M4 that we have with CGIS, you know, just because the neighborhood was pretty bad.
Full auto.
M4.
Yeah.
Smaller barrel, right. All that fun stuff. So there were times where I had that with me. And so we're sitting in surveillance. It's freezing cold. It's in the middle of winter. The best way I can describe what this dude looked like is because one of the people that knew him, like, I had to get like a description. I'm like, what does this guy look like? He's like Waka Flocka Flame. And at the time, I had no idea who that was, so I had to Google him.
Please.
Yeah, you got me.
Tall, slender. He's a rapper, and he's tall, slender. He's got like these small dreads that come down. He's kind of gangly, goofy, like always smiling. And that's exactly what our perk was. And it turned out like they're like brothers for the most part. Like, they look like brothers. It's hilarious.
You Google the picture, look up, right. And you're like, oh, there he is.
Yeah, I look at him. I'm like, oh yeah, that is a dude. That's cool. So we chase him down into this area. Like, we kind of cornered him down. We're working intel from people that know him, from snitches, and we finally get down to this one area. And we're just sitting there. And then one night we see this dude, this gangly dude, just walk by, and he goes right into this house. I'm like, oh my god! So we run a check on the house, see who it's owned by, and some names that pop up. We get that name. We run it by a couple sources. We have a source contact the girl that's at the house. And because her name matches the tattoos that were all over her face and neck. Oh. So we have him call her, and we ask, like, hey, is the guy there? She's like, oh, yeah, he's staying here. Cool. So our source calls us back and says, yeah, he's in that house. And then at 12:01 a.m., my team run up, we knock on the door really loud, and the girl with the tattoos all over her, she answers the door. We say, is Kevin here? She's like, oh, yeah. And we just file in, and we clear just by moving super fast up. We figured that he was upstairs, because that's where the bedrooms were on this of this residence. And as we're going up, everything's moving real fast. It's myself at point. I have a police officer right behind me and another CGIS special agent behind him. And we get to the end of this hallway. It's it's a door to a bedroom. It's slightly ajar. We push through. And it's a very, very small room, like maybe like maybe six feet across. But it's just filled with junk everywhere. Like, there's just bags of clothes, everything. I see my target right in front of me, but he's got his back to me. And he's got his hands digging through a bag. And we've already hit his house before where he's had a gun. He obviously knows that we're hitting the house, that we're coming in after him. We're screaming police the whole way up. And I go through the door, and I just scream out, like, hands, hands. And then I see a movement to my right, and I kind of do, like, a slight glance. And the police officer behind me, the laser targeting system on his pistol, it sweeps down. And it's, like, this two-year-old kid that's, like, squirming on the bed. And as, like, I see that, like, the trigger on my gun is getting pulled back. And if you've ever been in a stressful situation, like, your senses go bonkers, right?
Yeah, it slows down. Completely slows down.
Yeah. So, like, this all seems like it's taking, like, minutes. It's, like, dragging on. It's like, oh, my God. And, like, your vision tunnels out, and you start noticing certain things. all I can really, like, remember, like, the thing that sticks out the most is I could see the hammer on my gun coming back. And it was just, like, inching back towards me because I'm pulling the slack out of the trigger because all I see is his hands digging for something. I'm screaming for him to, like, show me his hands, and I don't want him turning around with a gun. Do I think at the time it could have been a good shoot? Yes. But, like, I could see the hammer was all the way back, and I think just the slightest twitch, and my hammer's going forward. But thankfully, I don't know who to thank for it. His hands shot out to his side like he's an airplane, and they were empty. And I was able to release on the trigger. I reached forward real quick, grabbed him, and brought him to the ground and sat on him. And as I'm holstering him, like tying up his hands, like I took that extra like half a second to breathe out and just like, oh my God, dude, I just almost smoked this guy. And I know there's a lot of officers out there that have been in shootings, that have been in very stressful situations, but like that one always sticks with me because like this dude was unarmed, and it makes you think back to all the training that you've had. Like, do you wait to get hit before you can hit back? Do you, like, how much time do you give someone to comply before you take action? What in each person's going to be different. I'm not going to ever say that the person behind me shouldn't have shot, and maybe they would have shot had they been in the front. But it's just one of those things, like, I almost smoked this dude, and like that would have been on me for a long time. I'm very thankful that I didn't have to, but that was a big deal for me. It was a lot of fun. Like, I look back, I'm like, man, that was a good chase, and I'm glad it ended the way it was, or the way it did. But we took him into custody. I even bought the dude McDonald's on the way to his interrogation.
Typical Coast Guard.
Which he complained about, and he said that he was a Burger King guy, which brought a lot of laughter. I was like,
you're a prison food guy now,
buddy. Yeah, right.
I was like, I just bought you your last free breakfast, like, out. Shut up and eat your hash browns. But he ended up getting, like, 2 years for his role, and then after we were done interrogating him and processing him, we rushed out and arrested the rest of his crew and brought them in, and they were all arraigned and kept for a while as well. But that was a fun and crazy time. Like, it just felt weird that, like, afterwards you look back and go, I almost killed that dude.
Yeah, Chris, I got two comments, I think, on that story. One, bravo Zulu, man, for hooking up your Coast Guard brethren, because all that came out of a dude, one of ours and one of our own, right, getting his motorcycle stolen. So that's cool. It's cool to know that that's, you know.
With that, he was the bad guy in the Honor Guard case.
Right. Well, still, you know, at one time,
so,
right?
A subject can turn to a victim within a heartbeat. Yeah, so right. Either way, you keep a professional. Yeah, he was a dirtbag in that case. But he is the victim in this, and he does deserve some kind of justice for it.
Very cool. And that's cool. And then I'll reiterate, man, I think I don't care how many gunfights somebody's been into. And I think especially on the law enforcement side where it's not wartime, it's not you don't have an identified enemy, right? Like especially with LE, there are so many things that go through your head in that split second that works out to you to be like 3 minutes, right? Like in your mind. I think I totally understand why that's memorable. And I think a lot of people have that same memory if they've been doing it long enough at some point.
Some version of that for sure. And it's, you're right. It's hard to judge what's the right answer, what's the wrong answer. Like, this turned out the right way for you, and thank goodness it did. But if you had gone another route, would you have been wrong?
You know, do you want to test the system? I mean, you don't want to pull your decision by saying, well, do you want to test the system and do you think they're going to back you up? You have faith in it. And, right. And like, if you're making the decision and you're doing the right thing and you can justify why you did it, you should be in the clear as long as you're following everything that is set forth for you, like law, policy, like all that stuff. Like, but that's why you got to just keep running it through your mind.
Right. Which is a good thing for those slowdowns, because it gives you that split second. It seems like you had an eternity to almost sit there and at least considering it as you watch the hammer come back is the way it feels like. Crazy. Yeah. Yeah, very good story, man. What? Tell us the one about Bahrain.
All right, so I think I was very fortunate with my tour in Bahrain. I believe I was the last agent to do a 2-year tour. There were two other agents before me that had done that. And there was always two agents at one time that were out there. And I got the last 2 year, and then they started bringing people out 1 year at a time. So I had two other partners while I was out there, and you know, God bless them. Like, they were amazing partners to have out there.
Did you guys get to live in the bungalows?
No. Actually, so for anybody that's thinking about going to live in Bahrain, do it. Oh my God, such an amazing, amazing place to live. Amazing, like a dynamic environment. Like, it's just insane how fast things are changing over there. What you got to deal with. I got out there right after the Arab Spring started. So, like, I'm getting out there, like, right as things are really ramping up in Bahrain. I missed the February 14th, like, big show that happened where, like, Saudi military came rolling into the island. But it continued on after that. So, like, while I was there, the protest and the Shia population, or, like, the people that were protesting from the Shia population, they were evolving with how they were doing, like, their tactics and everything that was going on. So while I was there, like, we saw them, like, creating homemade shotguns, creating homemade shotgun rounds, Molotov cocktails. Then they started building IEDs. And a lot of the stuff was believed that it was being learned from, you know, influencers from across the water in Iran. And they were fighting what they thought was, you know, the oppression of their people by the Sunni government. Me standing back and not taking judgment on any of that stuff. I mean, that's their country. That's their internal politics and what's going on. But we were sitting there stuck in the middle. And it was kind of weird because this dynamic of, like, you have the local population, you have the, you know, third country nationals, which are people that are brought in to do the work of, like, the manual labor and some other service work, Pakistanis, Indians, Bangladeshis, Afghanis, like, all these different Filipinos, Indonesians, all these people doing work there. And then you have us Westerners, because it's not just Americans, it's Americans, it's Brits, it's Aussies, it's, you know, Kiwis, all these different forces are there. And it was kind of like this unspoken, like, don't mess with the Westerners. And it's more to do with, like, because if you do, that's really going to bring the hammer down on us, because, like, they're the ones that give the government a lot of money. They're the ones that are protecting this region. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's like, make sure that we don't kill the Americans that are just happen to be wandering around. Like, you don't aim for them. That's what it kind of felt like.
Which is kind of a good impression for everyone to have. I mean, like, yeah, for at least for you, right?
Yeah, it is. But I'm also, like, in a position to where, like, I'm trying to gather information to make sure that our
sources and
yeah, and it's more it's not to, like, spy on the country. It's more to keep our sailors safe. Like, the whole concept was, hey, when are you guys gonna be lighting more tire fires out behind the base? And, like, you start getting to know the shopkeepers, like, hey, you know, stay away at 4 p.m. It's like, okay, thanks, buddy. And then you tell your folks, like, hey, guys, go out the front gate. I know it's quicker to go home out the back, but go out the front gate. Or you tell them, like, hey, guys, just stay in Jufair today. Like, they're going to leave Jufair alone, but Adlia's going to light off tonight. So just stay over there. And so that was more of what I was trying to do. And to do that, you got to go in those neighborhoods. You got to go talk to people. You got to go do, like, you interact with people. So that was part of my goal. And I lived out in town, just like everybody does. Everybody was in Jufair for the most part. I had a nice little flat in Adlia, which, have either of you been over to Bahrain?
No.
I'm not.
All right. Well, there's this area called Shawarma Alley.
Shawarmas are good. Yeah, I haven't been to Bahrain, but I've been to where they serve shawarmas.
I've been to Saudi, and the shawarma's good.
Yeah, so everybody and their mother loves shawarma because it's absolutely delicious.
I know. We don't have any over here. That's like that's my retirement gig. Is I'm going to buy a food truck, and I can't cook, but I'll, you know, maybe somebody can make court shawarma.
Third country national.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, I'm sure there's no issues with that. So there's this one street that is just famous throughout the area for, like, that's all that's lined up there. There's these little restaurants, and they do shawarmas. You drive up, and it's hilarious. And the guys that are shawarma places, you all get to know your favorite one. They see you in your car, and they come running over to you in traffic. You put your order, hey, two shawarma malgooms. Like, and then, like, while you're waiting in traffic, he runs it back over to you, and then you drive off. So, like, I lived right next to that. And that's a very well-known, like, area, and that's where there's a lot of other bars and restaurants, because there is alcohol in Bahrain. It's the Middle East. People a lot of times assume that there's no drinking. That's only in Saudi and Kuwait. because there's lots of drinking.
Yeah,
Bahrain.
They cross the bridge to go to Bahrain, right? Isn't that the deal? Yeah.
Yeah, there's two liquor stores in Bahrain. That's not counting the ginormous one that's on the base. There's two liquor stores in Bahrain, and they're drive-through.
Dude, hey, isn't it funny? Having never been to Bahrain, I still know where to drink on Bahrain.
Right.
So the drive-through liquor stores, it's fun because on Thursdays, that's when the Saudis, Thursdays and Fridays, the Saudis will come over the bridge and flood Bahrain for like the nightlife. You go over to the drive-through liquor store, and every car has a Saudi license plate lined up getting ready to roll through. And they're loading up for the weekend. But anyway, so as I'm there, like, we're still in the middle of the Arab Spring, and there's a lot of protests going on. A lot of, like, as I said, they started evolving to IEDs. And their version of IED would be take a gas cylinder, and not just necessarily, like, the little propane tank that you have, but think, like, the huge acetylene torch tanks. And then what they'll do is they'll wrap tires around that, and then they'll light the tires on fire. So the tank is filled, like half filled with whatever is normally in there. And then the tires will eventually heat up the tank because now you got like these, you got like five or six tires around it on fire. And eventually like the gas gets too much and it just explodes. And then you get the shrapnel of the acetylene tank that's shooting out everywhere. And then sometimes they would load like ball bearings inside the tires. So when it does blow off, you get like all the shrapnel that shoots out. So they started doing that, and a lot of times it's on like the border of their own neighborhoods. And then somebody learned how to make pipe bombs. And I know that when we say IEDs, a lot of people think like Iraq and Afghanistan, where you're thinking like they found like an old JDAM or something like that, and they've rewired it to blow up a Humvee. Well, an IED is anything that's just improvised and can explode. And a pipe bomb is an IED. And they vary in sizes. And we had one guy that started putting them around the island, and he was testing them out, we think. And he was putting them in like dumpsters in like highly trafficked areas. And unfortunately, that's where like a lot of these TCNs, they don't make a whole lot of money, or they get abandoned there, and they'll dig through the dumpsters for like whatever they can find. I remember one dude, he did that. It peeled his arm up like a banana because it went off when he picked it up. So I'm sitting in my flat. I'm up on like the third or fourth floor, and it's late at night. My flat is like right across from the Indian consulate, and it's a high trafficked area. And all of a sudden, like I'm kind of just like chilling about. Like it's maybe time for bed, but over there, like you're answering emails and phone calls until like whatever hour because you're so far off with U.S. time.
Great.
And my windows rattled, and like you hear this boom. And like I kind of stop, small smile, like, oh shit, sorry, I know what that is. And an IED had just gone off like across the street from my flat, and I kind of like look out the window. I'm waiting because I don't know if there's a secondary, and I'm counting it down, and like I start watching, and real quick, MOI, the local police, they start flooding the area, and they're like zipping back, like they're not even doing like a slow look, like they're just like flying by, and then you'll hear the dude screech his tires, and he'll turn around, and he'll flying back the other way, and like you kind of tell like he doesn't really want to stop to look, but he has to. And the MOI over there, it's not always Bahrainis that are the MOI. A lot of times they'll also have people that they've conscripted from Pakistan, and they'll be part of the police force as well. So it's a weird dynamic with the police force. But eventually they kind of zone in on where I can see where the smoke is, and the a little bit of destruction. It was put into like a container across the street. And I come down, and I'm staying within my building to kind of look out. And we're watching, and it's just like we had an ID. I call in to NCIS, and I'm letting them know, like, hey, we got an ID that just went off. And they're all excited, like, where is it? I'm like, across the street.
Right.
And that's when I was like, you are going to stay where you are. I'm like, obviously. And then after a while, like the crowds all gather around, which it's like you look back on it and you go, man, this is a good testing for whoever's building these IEDs, because within 5 minutes of him detonating his device, he had a nice crowd standing around where the device was. And like if you want to do mass damage, that's when your secondary would have gone off. So right. Like you just sit back and you watch, and it was a good learning point for us too. It's like, well, what's MY going to do? And you see them go directly towards the destruction. And you want to tell them to be careful, but then if you interact with them like that, then they're going to start looking at you like, why? What did you do? And it's like, all right, we're just going to sit by and watch. So that was my entertainment for the night. It was a nice little IED going off outside my flat. And I made a couple extra precautions of checking my vehicle before I hopped in it the next morning. And did like a nice little walk around of the building to make sure nothing looked out of place before driving off. But it was just a nice little excitement for the night.
Did they ever find the guy?
No. Well, I don't know. It could be that they did, and like, you know, through intel, like if you pick someone like that up, I don't think you'd want to make a huge announcement, or maybe you will like well after the fact. But
he just disappeared.
Yeah.
He could, and I don't remember too many more IEDs going off. There were quite a few, but after a while it stopped. Yeah, I don't remember too much noise. Too much noise about like what would have happened to the guy.
Right.
Right.
Well, hey, Chris, awesome stories, man. Thank you for taking us. I think we like ran the gamut right there.
You may have had one of the most interesting careers I think I've ever heard.
Yeah.
From escorting Navy ships through Gibraltar to getting IEDs in Bahrain and solving a motorcycle theft ring in Virginia. That's not what you think of when you think of the Coast Guard. That's awesome, man.
Yeah, very diverse, man. And
that was a lot of fun.
On to the EPA. Do they get to carry Mark 18s?
No.
Well, what's the EPA dress code? Is it like hemp shorts and Birkenstocks? Is that like?
No, I don't think I'm allowed to make any comments about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, we figured. Somebody had to bring it up, though.
But, you know, if you guys have any questions, like if you want to throw out any of the rumors that you hear, I'd be more than happy to try to dispel or just laugh at you for what you got for CGIS.
Well, I will say, like, number one, I'm impressed that C just investigated a crime against, even though he was a dirtbag, one of us. So that's pretty cool. That wasn't just member to member, right? It was somebody else. Granted, a few things had to fall in line, right? Like on a military installation, crossing state lines, but still good to know that resource is out there. And I think you make a great point, man. I've worked with some incredible CGIS agents on the external investigations, and then the internal is just kind of a mystery, I think, to most people.
I think people need to understand, for the internal, I mean, think about it, man. You can't come in there and like be everybody's friend. Somebody did something bad. And the whole point of CGIS to go after those people is to remove that corruption of the Coast Guard out of there, because that corruption can spread.
Right.
And it can be very vile to who we are as Coasties, and you don't need that. Like, I understand, like, the biggest thing that that people would complain about, like, especially those that pop positive for smoking dope, it's like, dude, it's illegal here, or it's legalized over here, and it's, like, the culture here. I had one guy give me, like, a lecture of, you know, how Washington was like. I'm like, all right, dude, I get it. I understand. Like, I'm actually, if you, like, now that I'm out of Coast Guard and CGIS, I don't care. Like, if I'm actually in full agreement with you, dude. I really do think it should be legalized. I don't care. But the rule is this, and the law states this. So we don't violate the law. Like, that's the rule that we have to follow. And if you sign your name on the dotted line as a Coastie, you got to follow those rules.
Right. You raised your right hand. You swore an oath. You signed the dotted line. Now shut your mouth and follow the rules or buy.
Yeah. And the people that you're buying dope from or marijuana from, they're not necessarily LE friendly, and you are part of an LE organization. So it's not like you're buying from, you know, the dude that's up in Mendocino that, you know, like even they're breaking the law and doing a bunch of bad stuff, but you're buying stuff from people that are smuggling it across. I've been on Coast Guard chases where we're out there in the middle of the ocean chasing drug runners, and the dude's got a gun on his, he's got like a gun rig on his thigh, and he's not playing by the same rules, but like, we got to fight him just so you can smoke a joint. I mean, it's tough. Like, rules will change. Society will change. But until then, hey man, we got to follow the rules.
For sure. I think, you know, all brings it back down to core values, right? Like, when you sign up, you have to adhere to the core values. It's just it's a must. And it might be, I think some people, the transition's a little rougher than for others.
Apparently.
But, you know, and the more senior guys are just, I always look at it as dudes that forgot that, right? They forgot the core values that they signed up to be with or to adhere to. So, yeah, man, excellent, excellent interview. And
yeah, thanks very much, Chris.
So much appreciate it.
Yeah. I thank you guys for what you're doing. I think it's awesome that you are bringing these stories out. Every Coastie has a great sea story somewhere, and it would be awesome, like, you know, interview everybody to get their stories out there. But I really appreciate what you guys are doing.
No, thank you. Thanks, and man. Hey, is there anything that we can get the word out for you about, Chris? Anything that you're into, or any issue or initiative that you want us to put out there for people?
No, not at this time. Okay. My last thing that I would say would be that, look, CGIS, like, I'm away from them now, and I'm on to what I'm doing now, but like, just remember that when it comes time for like them to interview you, like you're the victim or like something's going down, like they really do care about the mission. Like they really do care. It's just, it's hard to show a lot of that emotion. Like if you're dealing with a child pornography case, you can't like show that card that you hate life at that point. If you're dealing with a rape case, you can't, you know, show the victim that you're crying because it like what they've explained to you, like what has happened to them is like the worst thing that they may have ever heard. Like, they do care about the mission, and they, like, give them a chance.
Solid advice. Solid you miss advice, it, don't yeah. you, Chris?
Yeah, you can tell.
You miss it.
I do. Trust me, going from the fast-paced action CGIS to a little bit slower on the fraud, waste, and abuse, I do. But it's time for the next generation of CGIS agents, and I think they're doing – I'm sure they're out there doing an amazing job.
And just the Coast Guard as a whole. You miss it.
And the Coast Guard as a whole. Hey, yeah. My little brother's a Coastie stationed nearby. He's a reservist out here, and he's just kicking butt, and I love it. Coast Guard will always be part of my blood.
Awesome. Hey, awesome. Chris, we really appreciate it, man. Stay safe out there. Let us know if we can ever do anything for you.
Yes, sir.
All right, take care, Chris. Thank you.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.